You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Sports Tours International. Now, it will soon be early July and the Tour de France will be underway, and maybe that sparks dreams of riding the Étape du Tour, that great sportive event which gives amateur riders the opportunity to ride one of the great stages of the race and feel what it must be like to be part of the Tour de France peloton, not for 3 weeks, but for one fantastic day. They always pick the queen stage of the Tour in the mountains, and this year the Étape route will go from Albeville to La Plagne, tracing the route of stage 19 with 4,500 metres of climbing, which is enough to test even the strongest riders, going over the Col de Saisy, the Col du Pré, the Corme de Roseland, and up to La Plagne. Now, whenever I think of La Plagne, I always remember the 1987 stage there, when Laurent Fignon won the stage, and Stephen Roach saved his chances of winning the Tour with that fantastic pursuit of Pedro Delgado. Well, you can ride up that very same climb as part of the Étape's huge peloton of thousands of riders, and you can do so in style with Sports Tours International, because they have a whole range of packages to suit every type of rider. Perhaps you just want an entry-only option which will get you on the start line, but you have to look after all of your own logistics. Or my preferred option would be, let Sports Tours International take you there in style and look after you in the manner that a pro rider would expect from start to finish. All you have to do is pedal. They'll look after you before the race and after. They'll look after your bike. There'll be mechanics on hand to make sure your bike's in tip-top condition, and there'll be extra backup and support on the route as well. You'll stay in great accommodation near either the start or the finish, and there's even a VIP package too. Or maybe you want to be part of history and ride the inaugural Étape du Tour de France Femme. There's that option too at sportstoursinternational.co.uk. Now it's on with the podcast.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Lionel Burney, and in this episode we'll be discussing the most spectacular crash for a rider at men's Strada Bianca wearing the rainbow jersey since Julian Alaphilippe in 2022, and the thorny issue of whether Tom Pidcock should have waited, or if indeed he did wait. Joining me to do that is our very own Danish Super Tuscan, a man who recently moved from Tuscany, the home of Strada Bianca, to Liguria, the home of Milan San Remo. I'm anticipating that by October, he'll be living in Lombardy. And I know I made that joke last time he was on, but today he's thrown us a real curveball because he's coming to us from a car in California. It's Brian Nygaard.
Everything works in a car in California. You don't even have to leave the car when you're in California.
What are you doing over there, Brian? Slapping all the tariffs on the wine? Is that what, or should we not go there?
No. You should actually join me if that was the case. I'm in California to check up on the wine I made last year. So once the wine is in barrel, I don't get to taste it until I go back here. And so I tasted all my barrels, and I actually bottled one of my wines from 23. And I have to say, Lionel, I'm happy with where things are.
Wow.
At least regarding my wine. For the rest of the United States, that's another topic.
Well, as you know, sport and politics don't mix except when they do, so we'll swiftly move on. Also joining me is Rob Hatch, a man who spends more time in the commentary box than Tadej Pogacar spends in the break. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you. I tell you what, that's quite some time, isn't it? Deary me. I'm not sure that's good for everybody's ears, to be honest.
He wasn't in the break today, though, was he? He's given everybody a day off by not racing either Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico, but he did win Strada Bianca, and of course, we'll talk about that in the bulk of the episode. But before that, let's delve into the Musette of News, or Newsette, as I keep trying to call it. Daniel's not here this week, so I can really embed that phrase in the minds of the listeners. Who wants to go first? Perhaps you, Brian.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's a little bit easier for me to raise maybe a more speculative issue because I'm watching things from afar. or listening to rumors from afar, and they tend to get a little bit distorted that way. But I was kind of put on track to this when I went to California, because I had an involuntary stay at an airport hotel in Heathrow, Terminal 5. And I actually stayed at a hotel, and I remember I stayed there before because there was a plaque above the concierge that said this place was opened by Sir Cliff Richard in 2008. And I remember I had been there before meetings with Dave Brailsford and Fran Miller at the very dawn of Team Sky. And it sort of, you know, brought me to thinking about what's actually going on over there, you know, with Ineos. And I've been reading, I swear it's not Reddit, but actually, you know, real, substantial British media. And it seems like things are quite dreary over at Ineos, you know, Jim Ratcliffe's company, estimated debt of 12 billion euros. And even if he is the wealthiest man in the UK, living in Monaco, they have said farewell to quite a few sponsorships. And you know, my speculation, or the speculation that's maybe starting to somehow take off, is Ineos, next Ineos, you know, the Grenadiers, the pro cycling teams. So that's my speculative musette. And, you know, rumors are abound, and it's typical once the racing starts to pick up, you hear rumors from staff, riders even start to ask, and you know, you're both of a more journalistic ilk initially than I am, so I'm probably also asking you, is this musette worthy content, Lionel?
Well, it's more at the sort of jam sandwich made by a stressed soigneur end of the nutrition spectrum than than an energy gel packed with carbohydrate, isn't it? But there's clearly something going on behind the scenes with Ineos Grenadiers. I mean, they've had a great start to the season on the bike, haven't they? We'll talk about Tirreno Adriatico a little bit later on. Perhaps not the most surprising race win in the opening time trial. Filippo Ganna taking the first leader's jersey there in the Italian stage race. But they've been racing with real purpose, and that does suggest to me that something is brewing behind the scenes. We'll have to check it out. We'll see whether Daniel picks up any noise on the road from not quite Paris down to Nice over the course of this week. And who knows, maybe we talked last week about Rabobank coming back into the sport. You know, maybe cycling is fertile ground for a new or returning sponsor. We'll have to keep an eye on it.
Well, you could at least say that with the Rabobank, we can now add the disclaimer: crazier things have happened to anything in cycling after that.
Well, I don't think Team Sky are going to be reborn, are they? I don't think Sky will be coming back, but who knows what might be around the corner. Rob, what have you got?
On the sponsorship front, actually, if you've been watching Paris-Nice for the last couple of days, you might have noticed that Jonas Vingegaard is quite easy to spot now. I mean, he was always fairly easy to get, wasn't he? But in a big bunch of 170-odd riders, he's got a brand new helmet on. It's his national colours. It's white and red. That's because he's got a brand new national sponsor. I'll say a brand new sponsor. They've actually extended with the team and as a personal sponsor as well, I'm told. And as part of that, you know, Visma Lisa Bike, Richard Pulcher, they're always talking about trying to, you know, monetize new things and do things slightly differently. We saw that with the branding with the team, and it's going to be funny, actually. You mentioned Rabobank. It's going to be interesting where they take that now, because it's become sort of their brand, hasn't it, the yellow jersey? How do you get orange onto there? That's going to be something we'll see as the season goes on. But in terms of Jonas Vingegaard, he's going to be wearing this red and white helmet, we're told, for every race this season. And it's from, Brian, you'll help me out here, I think it's a Danish DIY company.
Yeah, it is. It's Bygma. You're really good with pronunciation, so you'll be quick to pick this one up. Yeah, so it is very much a DIY, and I think it's very much true to brand, to how not only the public perceives Jonas Vingegaard, but also how I think he's that type of guy. I could totally see Vingegaard on a Saturday morning in that DIY shop picking up, what do I know, like a chainsaw or some floorboards or whatever shopping list his wife has given him in the morning. And that's, he's that type of guy. And I actually, of all the Grand Tour candidates, on the podium candidates for the Tour, I see him as the most handy.
Very interesting. I like what you did there. I like what you did there.
Chainsaw. I mean, this is straying into Elon Musk territory here.
I'm
seeing Jonas Vingegaard much more as a sort of guy who his big job on a Saturday morning is to replace all the handles on the kitchen cabinets, and he pops off down to the DIY store to get the handles and the screws and the screwdriver. Totally on brand there. My little nugget of news that I'm plucking out of the musette is, we've been following this trend, Astana, trying to pick up points wherever they can to try and avoid relegation from the World Tour. XDS Astana, I should call them, as that's their new team name. They signed Sergio Higuita over the winter from Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. I thought that was a really interesting signing because Higuita had been very much a part of the kind of the quartet or quintet of GC type riders at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. And as a consequence, I think he found his own opportunities limited somewhat. But coming into Astana, XDS Astana, I felt like he was going to get a lot more opportunities. He's still only 27 years old, but unfortunately he's going to miss three big stage race opportunities this month. Not quite sure which one he was down for, whether it was Paris-Nice or Tirreno-Adriatico or Catalunya a little bit later on this month, but he probably won't be able to ride any of them because he crashed in training and has fractured his arm. And apparently it happened in a very heavy downpour. So Higuita, that's a blow for him, but also a blow for XDS Astana. I did also just want to mention that Patrick Lefebvre, who retired from his long-time role as the head honcho of Sudal Quickstep, was taken unwell last week, and we would like to wish him all the best for a speedy recovery.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by NordVPN. Now, NordVPN is a virtual private network, and primarily it's to keep your data safe and secure. I first signed up years ago when I was travelling for work, and I became a bit concerned about the security of the connections I was using to get online in hotels or race press rooms or even public hotspots. And I thought, well, if I'm that concerned when I'm moving around, shouldn't I also be concerned about the security of my connections when I'm at home? And so NordVPN gives me that security of knowing that my bank details, passwords and online identity are safe. And it also offers protection from viruses, malicious malware and phishing websites. You can use NordVPN on up to 10 devices, which means you can protect your laptop, tablet, phone, smart TV if you want, or even your internet router, which means that everything that's connected to your Wi-Fi is protected by NordVPN. It's the fastest VPN in the world too. There's no buffering or lagging while you're streaming, and you can get a great discount off a NordVPN plan now by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. Our link will also give you an extra 4 months free on a 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the episode description notes now. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP. Well, the big race of the weekend was Strada Bianca in Tuscany. The white roads and the gravel and all the dust that was thrown up from that race. Last week, Daniel asked me to make a prediction and I sat very firmly on the fence because I couldn't really see anything other than a Tadej Pogacar victory, if I was totally honest. And I know this sounds absolutely ridiculous because I thought, well, he's either going to win it or he won't. And that's always the case anyway. But I just felt like it was more 75% likely that he would win it, 25% likely that he wouldn't, and that it would be something like a very untimely crash or puncture that would get in the way of him and a third victory at Strada Bianca. And I mean, it nearly happened, didn't it? He survived that crash to become the first man to win two in a row at Strada Bianca. He was away on his own for the last 18.6 kilometres, quite different to last year when it was over 81 kilometres. But that race-defining moment came just before Sector 11 of the gravel, the climb of the Colle Pinzuto. Ironically, he didn't slip on the gravel. It was smooth road, but it was a kind of sweeping left-hand bend. Just under 50 kilometres to go, and his rear wheel gave way under him, slipped from under him, and he went, fortunately missing that post, but he went through the ditch and into the field and picked himself up, and he had quite some scuffs and grazes on his skin suit, his rainbow jersey skin suit and his skin. And then he caught back up to Tom Pidcock around 3 or 3.5 kilometres later. And Brian, I suppose the first question really, as you've been a team manager, is put yourself in Tom Pidcock's position, because Pidcock carried on, rode on, and then he kind of sat up, didn't he? 3.5 kilometres later, he sort of took a drink, he looked behind him, and he knew that Pogacar was closing back in on him. And I mean, I didn't see the race live, so I was following commentary online, and there was a lot of hoo-ha about Pidcock waiting. Should he wait? Did he wait? What's the right thing to do? And I was expecting it to be a bit more dramatic, but it seemed to me that he was kind of playing both sides of the net, really. You know, he rode on when he could, and then he sat up when it was the expedient thing to do. I don't know how you saw it.
Well, first of all, we also have to understand his conditions for deliberation in that situation, right? So they're in the breakaway, and they're all in on this, right? So Pidcock opened that sort of attack and got Pogacar with him, and then this was created. They're sitting there at almost 100%, and they're taking all kinds of risks, controlled risks, to keep this breakaway. There was a lot of interesting comment about that afterwards. But I think he doesn't have necessarily like 20/20 vision about what exactly is going on and what exactly is the gap and how is Pogacar in that moment. He literally has no idea. So I think it's a good way of saying it, that he's sort of playing both sides, because he has to. He also knows that, well, if I... in this situation, I invest everything in trying to keep the gap alone with 50 kilometers to go. If Pogacar comes back to me in 20 kilometers, he's going to drop me straight away, and I'm not even within a striking distance of a possible win. So he'll have to see and wait. And I would say, if he had taken Pogacar more than that, if he had waited more than that, and so his gap would have vaporized, then he would have had to set off. But he would need some kind of firm idea as to how well Pogacar was and how big the gap was, especially the gap of the chasers. So I think he was trying to get as clear an idea of the situation as possible and then make the wise choice. And I also think, and I don't think that's hindsight of Pidcock, I also think it's in his nature and in most riders' nature to wait when someone... it's not just an instrumental thing because you need the horsepower, but to wait for someone who crashes and at least see if they're okay and able to come back. Or not just have the race go on.
Yeah, I mean, there was still a long way to go to the finish, wasn't there? And as you say, Pidcock, if he had pushed on and kept that gap, he might have ended up just sort of dangling out there, and Pogacar would have reeled him in eventually, perhaps. But of course, as you say, you know, he didn't know initially whether Pogacar would even be back on his bike after that crash. So he had to think also about, well, what's the situation with Connor Swift, who was in that trio at the time of Pogacar's crash? What's the situation with the riders behind? He can't put the handbrake on and just stop his entire race and wait and see what happens. He has to ride on and wait and see what happens, really. And so I think, you know, sort of perhaps a slightly... looking for controversy where there wasn't really any. It was as much a racing decision as an etiquette decision, I think. And
exactly.
It just so happened that the two kind of, they were on the same side of the coin, really, for Pidcock.
Yeah, hanging in and around the commentary box and talking to the experts as well after the race, and they seemed to think the same. I've been talking to Sean Kelly as well this week, starting Paris-Nice, and he was like, yeah, I mean, he's not going to ride away, is he, all the way to the finish there? Certainly with what was coming and what was behind. On a different note, you mentioned Connor Swift. I felt for him, actually, because obviously he wasn't going to win the race, was he, unless something bizarre happened. But he was on for a fantastic position, and he seemed to be the most affected, bizarrely, by the crash out of the three, didn't he?
Yeah, but an amazing ride that he had afterwards, being able to actually finish the way he did. He's sort of definitely the unsung hero of that race. I mean, and everything is being dwarfed by Pogacar's, coming back after the crash and everything that he does. But I think he deserves a lot of credit for being able to hang on to that third spot after being in the early breakaway. Extremely impressive.
It really was impressive. I mean, he was one of three British riders in that early break. The other two were Lewis Askey and Mark Donovan. There were also three Danes in the break. It's almost as if the peloton knew, Brian, that the three of us would be joining to do the podcast today. But Connor Swift was a real kind of dangerous rider in that break. And the fact that You know, when Pidcock first made that little move, I mean, he did open it all up, didn't he, on the long gravel section with about 78 kilometres to go. And Pogacar was extremely alert and went by him. And initially, it was very hard for Pidcock to actually stay in his wheel. But they were on the break pretty much immediately. It's not like there was another 20 minutes or so before they bridged across to the rest of the break. And so Connor Swift really had to be strong and alert and react straight away to just get on the coattails of Pidcock and Pogacar. And it took him a little while to get up, didn't it? But I mean, what an effort that was.
It had looked like also before that Connor Swift was obviously was the strongest rider in the breakaway, but also the one investing the most in actually keeping the gap. So he was definitely on one of the best days he'd had on the bike, I think.
Can we just mention, while we're talking about the break, actually, you mentioned the Danes there, a little word for young Albert Witten. 18 years of age, the youngest man ever to ride Strade Bianche. In the break, on debut, we've heard everybody talking about him through the juniors, straight to the pros. I tell you what, that is just, that's just a tremendous feat to be where he was, I think.
But he's also, I mean, he's a junior world champion in mountain bike, cyclocross. I mean, he covers all disciplines. He's very young still, but I don't think there's a lot that he can't do. He just needs the World Tour volume in his legs. It'd be very interesting to see where he goes in the future. The numbers are apparently through the roof with this kid.
He's only a year older than Strade Bianche itself. He was born in 2006. The race started the following year. Extraordinary stuff.
That makes me feel very old, Lionel, but thank you.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, it was all about Pogacar, really, before and after the crash, wasn't it? I mean, he was in incredible form. He did say rather ominously before the race that his numbers were even better than they were last year. And I suppose it was a case of watching a race, wondering how he would win rather than who would win. I did quite enjoy the moment when they came down that descent again, approaching the Colle Pinzuto for the final time, past the scene of the crash, the little shake of the head as he went past, almost as if he couldn't believe what had happened to him. And just to pick up on something that was in the broadcast commentary, Rob, Adam Blythe had actually said, not 5 minutes before that incident, that Pogacar's rear tyre appeared to be a little bit soft. And I wonder if that was a factor going around that corner.
It's funny, actually, because they were also talking about Adam, Nathan and Robbie, who were all with me. They were also talking about the fact that because Pidcock was there, Pogacar perhaps wanted to put his chest out that little bit more and maybe live with him. And we got a hint of that in the post-race press conference as well from Pogacar. Whether he was playing up to the narrative and he'd been asked a question, I'm not quite sure, because he always plays that rather well, and it comes across as very humble, doesn't he? I think he said, yeah, I tried to be as good as him, and then used a swear word to say that he wasn't particularly well. I think it began with S. But no, you're right.
But I think they're interesting.
There were things, sorry, Brian, there were things maybe indicating that Pogacar was pushing it, whether it be mechanical or trying to put that chest out.
But I think it was an interesting testimony also from Connor Swift. I wouldn't say that he was sort of in the back seat just looking at them, but he made sort of testimony to the level they were riding at and to the risks they were taking. He said that it says a lot about how hard they race and how many risks they take, because he said they go all in every single corner. They ride it right to the limit. And he said that's actually one of the reasons why they're able to create such a gap, because he was convinced that they weren't riding like that behind the group. So he saw with his own eyes the level riders like Pogacar and Pidcock were riding at to be able to be in front of the race with such a gap.
The final move then came on that Colle Pinzuto, 18.6 kilometres to go. And, well, Pogacar kind of applied the pressure at the bottom of the climb, didn't he? I mean, there was no waiting. There was no kind of tactical subtlety to it. It was just, right, here it is, it's uphill. The opportunity to put Pidcock into a bit of difficulty. I mean, I wonder, you know, Pidcock rode exceptionally well, and he has won this race before 2 years ago when Pogacar didn't take the start line. But Pogacar, I think, has got a bit of an advantage over Pidcock in the sense that he's just that little bit heavier, maybe gets a bit more traction on the steeper gravel sections, or I don't know. That's kind of just armchair director sportif's opinion. At the end of the day, Pogacar was also stronger, wasn't he? But he got away.
Actually, on that, I was messaging this morning with a fellow Dane of mine, Alexander Kamp, who rides now for Intermarché, wants him on the World Tour. And we were debating, and we're probably going to talk about that as well, the fact that Mathieu van der Poel wasn't riding the Strade Bianche, and he would potentially, in my opinion, had been one of the only riders who had been able to compete against Pogacar together with Tom Pidcock, and maybe had made the final a bit different. And Alexander Kamp made the point that with the new parcours of Strade Bianche, with the addition of more gravel, and certainly with the addition of more climbing meters, he said that this race has now so much climbing that he thinks that it's not possible for Van der Poel to win in the company of, well, Pogacar in general, but also it's apparently from this year on a lot harder race.
Well, there's 82 kilometers on gravel now, and I think, thinking back to my notes, there's something like 4,000 to 4,500 meters of climbing. That's the elevation of a Grand Tour mountain stage, isn't it? And you only have to look down at just outside the top 10, Mikel Landa on debut. Again, not one noted for his ability on gravel or anything. He came 11th. Again, shows you what the climbing's like. Look who's missed the race the last couple of years as well. Van der Poel's decided not to go. Van Aert's decided to go to Mount Teide instead to get ready for the other monuments. You know, you've known Mads Pedersen turning up, people like that. It does suggest that it has changed, and it's certainly played much more into a rider like Tadej Pogacar's hands. The only other man that suits was probably the man who was second place, wasn't it? Because it's sort of the perfect ride for him. If you're ever going to design a race for Tom Pidcock, it probably would be that, wouldn't it?
I would like to see Van der Poel. I mean, the big story this spring is really, is Van der Poel able to push... Or the opposite, is Pogacar able to push Van der Poel in his own discipline? You know, last year Van der Poel was the king of the couple classics, and how far will that duel or that rivalry be able to go, especially in Flanders? You know, we don't know yet about Roubaix for Pogacar, but Flanders will be the big showdown to see who's actually the classic king amongst the two of them.
Yeah, let's have a word for UAE Team Emirates in general, though, because they did play the perfect setup for Tadej Pogacar. They had such a strong lineup, and they went through their riders one by one. I mean, it was pretty well sorted out by the time we got the TV pictures on Saturday, and they still had riders to spare, didn't they? And Tim Wellens managed to get the third place on the podium. A really kind of thoroughly all-round excellent day for the whole team, not just Pogacar. And I suppose, you know, when you look at the rest of the results and the time gaps, you know, almost as significant as they were last year when Pogacar made that 81-kilometre solo attack. So it really was a kind of a, as the rest of the riders came in for the finish, it was a kind of like, there was that sort of sense of polite applause for the valiant and the vanquished, really, wasn't it? It was like Ben Healy fourth. That's actually a very, very good result, even though, you know, it was kind of on the second page of the script almost. And as you say, Rob, you know, this kind of mashup of classics riders and Grand Tour riders. I mean, fifth, Peo Bilbao, sixth, Magnus Cort. I mean, Magnus Cort is a sprinter, roadman, classics guy who can climb, who had a fantastic week at O Gran Camino a couple of weeks ago. It's a race that really does bring these different types of riders together. Connor Swift ended up finishing 13th, 5 minutes 33 down. As you say, Brian, that really was sort of man of the match performance for Swift. And just a little plug for my Friends of the Podcast episode recorded at the UCI Gravel World Championships last October in Leuven, where I really, the theme was the way that all of these different disciplines are now overlapping and they're sort of coming together at certain key points in the season. There was a lot of criticism about that UCI Gravel World Championships, that it was really a mixed surface World Championships. There wasn't a lot of gravel involved. But I spoke to Connor Swift for that episode because he was sixth in the UCI Gravel World Championships, and he's really excellent at these kind of races. He's won Trobriand-Leon in the past in Brittany. He's been fifth at the Clásica Jaén, the sort of Spanish equivalent of Strade Bianche. And yeah, he had an excellent day out, the best of the riders from the break. But he was only actually a second ahead of Lewis Askey, who was also in that early break and rode very, very strongly onto the finish in 19th place. Did anything else catch your eye from the men's race on Saturday?
I just want to make a comment about how it looked again. you know, it catches our eye every year. Brian knows it better than most of us. I was lucky to study in Florence when I was learning Italian and what have you. I spent 6 months there. But I tell you what, every time I see that every year on the television, I think, God, why do I not go and spend more time there? It looked glorious. And you know, you had the rainbow jersey. You had a wounded rainbow jersey. The way it was won, the drama, it was just perfect. The moment those first few riders went into that square to get that adulation. And the same, and I know we'll talk, you know, the cycling podcast Femina, we'll talk about the women's race, but we had a great storyline there as well. And it was just perfect from start to finish, all day long. Stories everywhere, drama everywhere. It was Italy at its very best.
Well, Rob, I've seen it in slow motion because I wrote the Gran Fondo in 2018. So I've seen it in like the possibly the microscope version, every single gravel sector and every single stone. And yeah, I actually spent a month there last summer. And I can, to our listeners, I can also recommend going there because once you're on the gravel sectors and there are in the Comune di Siena, I mean, get a hold of this, 5,000 kilometers of Strade Bianche in total.
How many?
It's an 5,000 kilometers. It is the most immense network of gravel roads crisscrossing through the vineyards. And so you can spend an entire day. I was actually, Jerry Gruber, the brilliant photographer who also takes together with his wife, Ashley, some of the best cycling photography, including from Strade Bianche. He sent me a lot of routes where he said he could spend an entire day on the Strade Bianche in this region, you know, between Florence and Siena, really south of Siena too, and not see a car during an entire day. So it is very desolate, very beautiful, and yeah, it's good for the soul to ride your bike there.
I'm just off to book a flight.
I wonder, Brian, if the winemakers are all sat in a car over there somewhere feeling very pleased with themselves about the wine they've made.
Probably.
I went to Strade Bianche in 2022, and I was thinking about this race a little bit earlier today because it does seem to mark a kind of a really definitive line in the career of Tadej Pogacar. Of course, he'd won the Tour de France before. He was one of the best riders in the world at that point. But it was when he laid down that marker almost with the near 50-kilometer solo break. And I can remember standing in the Piazza del Campo at the end. It was rather chilly. We were waiting for the formality to be confirmed. And we've just seen more and more of this from Pogacar. He was not the first rider to launch a 50-odd kilometre break. I mean, Fabian Cancellara has done it in Paris-Roubaix. Other riders have done it in big classics. But it does feel like this race kind of was the real kind of the moment that today Pogacar turned from, you know, boy to man. And it does feel a little bit like if he's on the start list for the next 2 or 3 years, there's a big question mark about how anyone could go about beating him, because I can't see an answer, really. I mean, what could you do? Send a more powerful break up the road early and get two or three riders of Conor Swift's caliber into it, maybe? I mean, that seems to me to be the only possible way to put him on the back foot.
You definitely have to rewrite the traditional way of trying to win a one-day race. But I think that we're always... Well, I suppose every time, and that's going to happen a lot, I think, this spring and the rest of the year, Pogacar wins, the crowd of people saying, oh, this makes cycling more boring, and, you know, what's the inclination now to even watch these races? I'm completely the opposite end of it, but each to their own. But I think that obviously the other teams and the riders, even riders at a higher level than just, you know, don't no disrespect to the riders going in the early breakaway, but I do think they'll have to think of something than just, you know, waiting to be dropped with 50, 40 odd kilometers to go. So the interesting thing would be to see riders potentially, you know, podium candidates going in that early breakaway, trying to shake things up in a completely different way, you know, getting rid of the traditional manuscript for how to race a one-day classic, as I think Strade Bianche is by now.
Yeah, I think there's a real kind of two ways of looking at domination, isn't there? I mean, to a certain degree, I find dominance by, you know, one person quite a boring narrative. And yet, on the other hand, I acknowledge that, you know, when Tiger Woods won every tournament going, audiences for golf went up, interest in golf went up. You know, people want to see the best in the world, they want to see how they continue to, you know, reinvent themselves perhaps, or deliver when the pressure is on them most. And I mean, really, this has just sort of whetted the appetite for the rest of Tadej Pogacar's spring, because he's really gone for a classics lineup. This question about whether he'll ride Paris-Roubaix will continue until about midnight on the night before the race on, what is it, the 13th of April. His team are saying, look, wait, Tadej, it's too dangerous. You don't want to jeopardize the Tour de France. But I'm just getting a sense that he may, with just a sort of boyish, carefree abandon, line up for Paris-Roubaix and see how it goes and hope for the best. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Well, Rob, you mentioned the women's race at Strade Bianche and the Cycling Podcast Femina. Rose Manley, Denny Gray and Rebecca Charlton will be back later on this week with their recap of the women's racing so far this season, focusing on Saturday's race, which was won by Demi Vollering of FDJ Suez. SD couldn't throw a spanner in the works. As they did at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad a week ago. Demi Vollering won the race for the second time in her career. Anna van der Breggen, not a bad comeback from her mini retirement, a 3-year mini retirement, second place for SD Works. And then, well, it was a shootout for the final place on the podium between two French riders. Pauline Ferrand-Prévot got it for Visma Lisa Bike, just ahead of Vollering's FDJ Suez teammate Juliette Labousse. But Rose and co will have a far more detailed breakdown of what went on in that race. We'll just recap some of the other racing that's gone on in the past week, because there were a couple of belters, weren't there? Matthew van der Poel pinned on a number for the first time this season at Le Samin and climbed onto the top step of the podium for the first time this season. An excellent second place for Paul Manier, who was also second at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. Can't help but think that a very big win is coming his way soon. But I think, you know, the Pogacar, Vingegaard, Van der Poel blueprint, which is when they race to win. Le Samin is not a big race, is it? And yet he went out. He could have just sat in the bunch if he'd wanted to, but he didn't. He went and he got over the line first. There's a real kind of trend here, isn't there? No race is not worth winning for these guys, it seems.
I do, however, wonder whether he'd been there if it hadn't been nice and sunny in Belgium and raining down on the east coast of Spain. I heard a little rumour that might have triggered the fact that he wanted to go and race a little earlier. What he did do was go one better than his dad. His dad finished second in the semi back in the day. So the trophy's finally in the Van der Poel household.
Well, I can say also, Lionel, don't underestimate Samin. In the merry spring of 2011, when a fledgling Luxembourgish team were very short on victories and a growing frustration from one Italian owner, Flavio Becca. And Samin was our first win that season with Dominik Klemme, fair ginger-haired German rider. And I tell you what, a victory in Samin has never been grander and caused more joyous jumping around. It's a race that I would always have a very fun place in my
heart. Were you fearing for your job at that point? Were you like the manager getting given the dreaded vote of confidence and you desperately needed a win?
Every single day, my friend. Every
Just
single
a brief
day.
Mention on the weather, because the one thing that does occur to me about Strade Bianche is if there was a real wet edition. I mean, can't remember a really wet edition. That could be the thing that would upset the Pogacar Express. 2018.
2018. Because I remember I rode the day after.
Oh, no.
I certainly remember 20. It was snow. It was snowing when I was driving from Pietrasanta to Siena. But it actually meant, and then this is, I'm not going to bore you with wine and geology details, but you know, that whole area is a mixture of calcareous soil and clay, which is often in wine terms quite relevant for how you can make wines suffer and make great wine. And there is a lot of clay, and clay is... it's good for drainage. Clay will keep a lot of the water. So it actually oftentimes, in Tuscany it says battuto, so it means that it's quite beaten down. And then when there's been cars across, as we know, it'll, you know, happen in the women's race, and it will happen with the race cars coming across. the mud actually soaks up a lot of the water, so it's not always that muddy. There's so much drainage in the clay soils and of that part of Tuscany. So it'll be muddy, but not necessarily that muddy. I think the dustier version is actually more stressful for the riders.
Well, Trofeo Legrelia, another race in Italy, very much your home race now, isn't it, Brian? Really? And what a great race it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful course. Yeah, it's a beautiful course.
Been.
I mean, it sort of overlaps with the Milan-San Remo running, doesn't it? And that circuit they do with the three laps of the Colle Micheli and the Capo Mele. The Capo Mele is part of the run into the Cipressa.
Was the Capo Mele in the wrong way, isn't it?
That's
they go in the opposite direction.
But that loop is absolutely fantastic. And the Micheli climb itself looks like a sort of little version of the Cipressa. Even when the motorbike's filming back down the climb and you can see the sea, it's very, very similar looking to the Cipressa. And it was an absolutely belting race. Juan Ayuso, another UAE Team Emirates rider, he won it. He'd been third and second in the past, and he finally got the victory. But it was he was pushed all the way by Christian Scaroni. And Michael Storer was up there, Nielsen Paulus was up there, Alberto Bettiol, Michał Kwiatkowski. It was a real strong group. And I know in some of these small races, you know, there's probably 8 or 10 riders of that sort of caliber, but they all came to the fore and they all shaped that finale. Really terrific watch. There was the Grand Prix Claude Criquillon in Belgium, named after the late world champion who won the world championships in Barcelona, I think it was, in 1984 for Belgium. And another great day for Q36.5. I mean, in all the talk of Tom Pidcock in the previous part, we barely mentioned the fact that that was a huge result, runner-up at Strade Bianche for the Q36.5 team, not least because of the points it will give them. But Matteo Moschetti, he won the Grand Prix Coquillon in Belgium, and his teammate Giacomo Nizzolo was third, and they were either side of Ugo Hofstetter of Israel Premier Tech. And three small races I'm just going to mention just because they caught my eye. One was Jonathan Milan's younger brother, Matteo, won the Trofeo Podec in Croatia for Lidl Trek's development team. And young Matt Brennan, who really caught the eye in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad for Visma Lisa Bike last weekend. He dropped down to race for Visma Lisa Bike's development team at two small races in northern France, Le Tour des 100 Communes and the Grand Prix Lillers, and he won both of them. So a good weekend for Darlington's Matt Brennan. And now let's look ahead really to what's to come the rest of the week, because we're in this phase of the season where pretty much everyone is racing, but they're split between Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico, these 2 week-long stage races. Rob, you've had a very keen eye on Paris-Nice so far. We've had two stages. They've both gone the way of Tim Melia. What else has been going on?
Rather too much has been going on, I think. When we didn't expect it, there's been sprinting for every corner. It's been like watching the run into, I don't know, the Molenberg or something, where you're all racing for that turn, or the run into the next cobbled sector in Paris-Roubaix. There's been a lot of keeping everybody at the front, and that has been causing a lot of nervous energy. On stage two, particularly in Paris-Nice, the one we had just before we were speaking, there's often wind blowing, isn't there? And that can naturally make things nervous. But we haven't had anything. It's been still, it's been quiet, but the peloton has been anything but that. They've not really given the break a chance. That's fine. That's the sprint team's prerogative, isn't it? That's sort of modern racing. But behind, there's been so much nervousness in the bunch that we've had a couple of nasty crashes. Luke Durbridge didn't look in a great way today. Gorka Sorarain as well, he went down. We saw Florian Senechal wheeled away into an ambulance with what looked like it could have been a shoulder or a collarbone. Yeah, lots going on. We all know it's sort of part of Paris-Nice, unfortunately, but we know it's part of Paris-Nice when you've got, you know, the wind blowing or a race into a final circuit. This sort of stuff's been happening at 50, 60 kilometres to go. And just hearing a couple of the interviews at the end today from some of the riders, Mats Pedersen in particular, who's never one to sort of keep quiet what he feels. And he was just hinting that, you know, certain teams were, he didn't mention the team's names, but he was, you know, saying that the certain teams were going for every corner and keeping their guys at the front. And that was causing crashes in his mind.
Oh, it was. I was watching other interviews and other comments, and they were very vocal about Visma Lisa Bike going way too early to the front and causing that nervousness. You know, Victor Campenaerts in particular, also yesterday, And I mean, everyone, I think, should race the way they feel like, and they're there to try and win. But I can also see it from the other side, that if a GC team starts to meddle with the sprinters team's setup at a point in the race where it's unnecessary when there's no wind, I would probably side with the sprinters teams. You know, there is a certain division of labor at Paris-Nice. It's a race in two halves, isn't it? Especially when there's
no
wind.
But on the other hand,
Visma Lisa bike, sorry, Lionel, but they'll argue, won't they, that, like you say, that they were doing the right thing, because Matteo Jorgensen, for example, he's picked up, what is it, 6 bonus seconds over the course of the first couple of days. He's had a superb start. Vingegaard's been kept nice and safe. And Axel Zingli, well, he's been up there in the top 10 twice on the sprints, I think.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
Yeah,
for
I was going to make exactly certainly that point. You know, in a stage race like Paris-Nice, which could be decided by seconds, you know, teams are entitled to go for the time bonuses on the flat stages as well as on the hillier stages. So, you know, the course creates the racing, then the teams create the racing, and when it comes, push comes to shove, no pun intended, you know, sometimes something gives, doesn't it? And you know, aggression can be rewarded by results, and as you say, you know, each team has to race the way that they want to race, and there's a real fine line between, you know, what is acceptable and what can cause a crash, because sometimes it isn't necessarily the dangerous move, you know, in the first third of the bunch that causes the problem, is it? It's what happens as all of that stress and pressure concertinas down the bunch. I mean, you mentioned the Luke Durbridge crash today, Rob. That seemed to happen right towards the back of the bunch. So it's just a case that it's all about what's going on at the front. The racing is on from first place down to 150th place. And, you know, sometimes on these stages with all of the road furniture through these parts of France as well, it's often, we watch on TV, don't we? And the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, how have they crashed here where it's barriered and it's straight and what have you? Well, that might have been brewing from where it chicaned 2 kilometres ago, and it went round a roundabout and everybody was stretched out and all came back together. You know, when the stress is on, the stress is really on. Tim Melier, though, 2 wins out of 2 for Sudal Quickstep. It's like the old days, isn't it, of Tom Bonan winning a couple of stages at Paris-Nice and having the leader's jersey. Yesterday, he and Arnaud Démare were quite close together. Démare pushed him quite well to the line, didn't he, for RK at B&B Hotels. First time I've really seen him sprinting that well for a little while, I think. I suppose he was reasonable at Bessèges, wasn't he? Got a couple of second places there. But what do we anticipate over the rest of the week, Rob? We've got the team time trial tomorrow, haven't we? This Tour de France warm-up. What is it? 15 months warm-up to the team time trial in Barcelona. This format that we've seen the last couple of years at Paris-Nice, where it's sort of a team race until it's not, and then it's every man for themselves. That will be interesting to watch. And then I guess it's the usual menu as they make their way down to the Côte d'Azur.
Yeah, there will be a breakaway day later in the week, I'm sure. A long stage when they get towards the southeast. We've got the mountain stage that we couldn't have to Oran last year. That takes place on the Saturday, then the typical Nice stage, which is often one of the best racing days of the year to me. That 100-kilometre dart into the backcountry behind Nice, finishing with Col d'Aise and then descending back into Nice. That's always a wonderful racing day. Even if the GC by then does look all right and done, there's always something going on there. There's always a chance for something to change. And the team time trial that comes up on stage 3, it's going to be on the racing circuit in Magny-Cours, then head into Nevers, just up the road. There'll be good memories for John Degenkolb there. He won the last time the race visited there, I think it was 2014. Also, like you just said, there's sort of something for everyone, isn't there, on Paris-Nice? And that's what makes it such an interesting race.
I picked up on something regarding Visma Lisa bike, because they quite openly with the media say that they are in this race with 2 captains. And obviously, Danish mainstream media are, you know, waving their fist in the air about how can it not be only Jonas Vingegaard. They obviously seem to forget that Matteo Jorgensen won the race last year. But it is quite interesting given the format of the team time trial, that it's the last man, you know, or whomever finishes last that gets the time. And seeing that Matteo Jorgensen picked up these bonus seconds, it can't be all, you know, in vanity. So I expect both him and Vingegaard to be able to hold it together, both of them, until the end, or else it would have been pretty bogus that they would have gone for these seconds. And then it'll be quite interesting to see how they will actually race together to figure out which of the two of them is going to win this race. Vingegaard said to the Danish media that he would be very happy if Jorgensen won Paris-Nice. His focus is the Tour de France, and he certainly would like to see his teammates pick up success.
I mean, he's got a Danish surname. Surely the Danish media are professional enough to claim him as one of their own. I mean, that's what we do here in Britain, Brian.
Well, one would think, but yeah, that's not the case.
Unless
now he's got that helmet. He's got that helmet.
The DIY
now,
helmet. You know. Yeah, he might be left to his own devices. DIY stage racing for Jonas Vingegaard. not so good news for another Danish rider. I've been really interested to see how Kasper Asgreen gets on at EF Education Easy Post. I mean, it's a kind of a new start for him, isn't it? And, you know, he has less of the Soudal Quickstep type pressure. But in a way, the pressure kind of flips around because he's such an outstanding classics rider in a team that could do with a classics rider. And he was ill overnight and didn't start stage two. So that may well hamper a little bit of his preparation. We'll obviously recap Paris-Nice in full next week. Daniel Freiber is on the road from not quite Paris down to Nice with ITV. He's television's Daniel Freiber this week, and we will catch up with him, of course, next week. Well, he'll be back in the hosting chair, won't he? I'm sure he'll be elbowing me aside like a Visma Lisa bike lead out man. Tirreno Adriatico, though, got underway today with a slightly underwhelming time trial, I have to say. It wasn't the greatest of courses. Maybe that was because of the weather. I don't know, that part of Italy. Are you aghast at my summary there, Brian?
It's my former home, basically my former hometown. Well, close, it's my former local beach, but I would actually agree with you.
I'm talking more about the course. It was a little bit kind of up to the roundabout, and back again.
It's a hot dog circuit, really, isn't it? There's nothing interesting to be said about. I remember one year, actually, when there was a team time trial, and it was just changed ever so slightly so that it could ride past Oleg Tinkov's house. I believe he still has a property there, actually. But no, I agree with you. It's not the most inventive of race architecture.
And, well, Filippo Ganna won the stage for Ineos Grenadiers. Quite a convincing victory, as you might expect from such an accomplished time trialist. And, well, what else did we learn about Tirreno Adriatico? I mean, to me, Juan Ayuso finishing second in the time trial, having won Itzulia last year, having been second at Tirreno Adriatico last year, he's probably the outstanding favourite for the overall now, I would say. I mean, the time gaps aren't huge, but that's a nice little advantage for him to have after only, 11.5 kilometres of racing.
Very strong team behind him. Very strong team behind him. I think that UAE is just going to continue their winning streak, and it actually puts more pressure on Visma in other races than it does per se for UAE in this race. I think they're the outright favourites to win Tirreno, and well, luckily Visma is in Paris-Nice as well. But I think, you know, Adam Yates has all the firing power to be there on the climbing stages for Ayuso, if not even winning it himself.
Well, we shall see how that unfolds. I mentioned that all the best riders are split between these two races. The exception, of course, Tadej Pogacar, who has his win in the bag from Saturday, and his stage race this week will just be from, I think it's called the Couch to Cafe Classic. Six or seven stages of that. He's earned it. Let's finish up here with another visit to Kurovitz Corner. Ugo Kurovitz, veteran reporter, of course, for Het Nieuwsblad, And I think he's done 30 plus years on the beat, covered all the races. He's gone everywhere that the Belgians have gone. Like a good newspaper journalist, he has found the Belgian angle absolutely everywhere. And we'll see what he has in store with Cordovic's Corner this week. I have a feeling he didn't have to look too far for the Belgian angle.
The attention freebie, don't look for me in Paris. For the first time this century, I'm not there. It gives me very, very mixed feelings. La Course du Soleil was my favorite one-week stage race. But on Sunday afternoon, I had to laugh when I saw the finish photo of the bunch sprint. Only Tim Merlier was on it. This was a unique photo of a unique rider. Tim Merlier, and not Tim Merlier, as the Frenchmen always say, is a special one. You won't find a top sprinter much cheaper. He doesn't need a train like Jasper Philipsen or Mats Pedersen. He only needs his childhood friend, Bert Vallerberghe, to drop him off perfectly. He'll do the rest himself. After a victory, I know, you'll never get the quotes from him. He's much too down to earth for that. Much too modest. He reminds me of Brik Schotte, the double world champion who summed up bike racing as riding fast when you have to ride fast. Merlier remains the boy next door who grew up in the pub St. Arnoldus at Plaintje with Mother Heidi under the church tower of Wortegem-Petegem. Merlier is a Flandrian like they don't make anymore. He's a product of generation of Belgian riders. First, there was Mario de Klerk, who discovered how fast the young Merlier really was. The three-time cyclocross world champion is from the same village. He was the one who advised him to race on the road. 8 years ago, de Klerk solemnly predicted to me, Hugo, he will be the fastest sprinter in the world. But none of the team managers wanted to believe de Klerk. There was no other option than to ride the Kermis races in a no-brand jersey less than 6 years ago. Until Christophe Rothoft brought him in at Corendon Circus for the minimum wage. As teenager, Merlier idolized Frank van den Broeke. More than 5 years ago, Merlier fell in love with Cameron, the eldest daughter of Il Bimbo d'Oro. Cameron often came to watch the cyclocross races. He not only became the father of Jules Frank Merlier, but he also inherited Jean-Jacques van den Broeke as Cameron's grandfather. Papi Jean-Jacques is Tim Merlier's mentor. Every morning, before 9 o'clock, he calls Tim, and after the training, he's there again to ask how the training went. Unlike Frank van den Broeke, Tim always listens to his good advice. Frank van den Broeke's father experiences his eternal youth with Tim Merlier. And then there is Mark Martens. He's the younger brother of the two-time world champion Freddy Martens, who himself spent several years in the pro peloton. He was also a fast one in the Kermis circuit, but did not have the same qualities as Freddy. Mark Martens is perhaps the biggest fan of Tim Merlier. The knowledge of generations of Flandrians is passed on to Tim. Tim may be very humble, he is hungrier than ever, even though the European champion will be 33 in October. Merlier also has a lot of dreams that he wants to see fulfilled, such as wearing the yellow jersey in the Tour de France, one day winning Gent-Wevelgem, the race that is run on the training course of his late father-in-law, Frank van den Broeke, or shining in Paris-Roubaix. Although his biggest dream remains to one day become world champion. He will not get his first chance at the rainbow jersey until Abu Dhabi 2028. I will be almost 36 by then. Who knows which young sprinters will push me to the crown? Because I only got a real chance when I was 26. I will not be satisfied even then, says Merlier about his distant dream. In the meantime, he tries to grab everything he can. And he did it again on Monday in Bellegarde for a new unique Finnish photo, but this time in the yellow of Parinis.
Well, always good to hear Hugo there. I mean, as the big, big classics come, my appetite for hearing what he has in store would just, you know, goes up and up and up. It will be, I don't know how we're going to stop him. He'll probably be doing 15 or 20 minutes before the Tour of Flanders, won't he? Maybe we should play it.
Love it, Lionel. My new favourite part of the show, I have to say. I love his
Maybe
voice.
We should play in full a Hugo Kurowitz corner in the 1101 Cappuccino, which is our weekly Substack email newsletter, kind of modern, old-school way of communicating. But you can sign up for that for free and get it in your inbox every week. Just go to thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you want to listen to that special from the Gravel World Championships that I referred to earlier on, just sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and your support will help us to continue to cover all of the racing over the course of the year. We'll be back next week to recap Paris-Nice with Daniel Freiber, and Tirreno Adriatico. We'll wait eagerly to see what those two races have in store. But until then, a big thank you, Brian. I hope your wine continues to delight as you open those barrels.
Thank you very much, Lionel.
And thank you, Rob. You can go straight back to the commentary box now. I know you sleep in there. You eat all your meals in there. I know you're much more comfortable in there. So look forward to hearing you in the commentary box again tomorrow.
Thanks, Lionel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freib, and Lionel Byrne.